Let me welcome all of you to this great occasion here at Dickinson College in Carlisle on this beautiful fall day where we come to you. And today the Judicial Independence Commission, the Pennsylvania Commission on Judicial Independence, and the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues are co-sponsoring what we believe will be a most interesting and illuminating event. Now allow me to briefly talk about our co-sponsors before we commence our panel discussion. First, the Clark Forum. Founded in 1994 here at Dickinson College with a generous gift from Trustee Henry Clark, the Clark Forum seeks to connect the students, faculty, and broader community with scholars, practicing professionals, and activists through the use of lectures, seminars, and conferences. The Clark Forum, as part of its mission statement, states that it believes that knowledge and understanding are gained through critical reflection and the informed exchange of divergent ideas. I want to take this opportunity to thank Professor Harry Pohlman, the Executive Director of the Clark Forum, as well as Dickinson's President, Bill Durden, and Provost Neil Weissman, all of whom helped to bring this event to fruition and brought us here today. So I thank all of them, and in fact, everybody on staff here at Dickinson College who have been so enormously helpful as we planned out this event. And really, the planning has been the better part of 6 months. The Pennsylvania Commission on Judicial Independence was formed by our Supreme Court in 2004 and formally impaneled in 2005. It has as its principal goals fostering a better understanding of the role of the courts in a democracy and countering unfair attacks on the judiciary. The Commission has worked tirelessly to raise public awareness of the importance of a strong, independent judiciary in a free society. I would like to recognize at this time, in particular, Tom Darr, the Deputy Court Administrator of Pennsylvania, and the esteemed co-chairs of our commission, the Chief Justice Emeritus of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, John Flaherty, and Justice James Fitzgerald, for their assistance and the very ardent blessing that they placed on this event today. They have been with us, and they were enthusiastic about this program from the very start. In 2008, I was privileged to attend a forum in Washington, D.C., entitled Justice and Journalism. Among other things, it featured a mixed panel of federal judges and journalists who were engaged in a Socratic discussion by eminent journalist John Siegenthaler, founder of the First Amendment Center. It is from that experience that we designed today's program, and I would be remiss if I did not give abundant credit, in fact, to Mr. Siegenthaler and the First Amendment Center for their assistance. We contacted them as we decided that we wanted to bring this program to the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and through my contacts and through John Curley's contacts, they have been wonderful in lending their assistance and giving us sort of their playbook for the event. So what do we hope to achieve today? Well, as to the third branch, if you look around a bit today, you see ample evidence that judges and courts are not universally held in high esteem. Catchphrases like judicial activist are bandied about with regularity. State judicial retention elections, elections for open judicial seats, and the appointment process for federal judges have all become, at times, a sort of blood sport exercise. On the journalism side of the ledger, we know that the earliest use of the phrase Fourth Estate dates back to 1841 when Thomas Carlyle said this in his book on heroes and hero worship. And I quote, Edmund Burke said there were three estates in Parliament, but the reporters' gallery yonder, there sat the Fourth Estate, more important than them all. And that was the first recorded reference, for those of you who didn't know that, of the Fourth Estate. But today, with issues such as the electronic media, including, of course, blogging, declining circulation, by newspapers, and the sort of concomitant reduction of reporting staff and resources, the challenges facing the Fourth Estate as they endeavor to cover our courts have never been greater. And that's clear to us, those of us who work in the courts, and it became even clearer to me through the exercise that I went through in May of 2008 at the Freedom Forum. So as judges, the new paradigm that has been thrust on journalists means that we have to rethink how we deal with the press on a day-to-day basis. That's part of what this exercise is about, because historically there was not necessarily a relationship where the judiciary understood and respected not just the role of the press generally, but also the mechanics of how courts get covered. So there are some very rudimentary points that I think we'll get into today in that vein as well. Now, within the Constitution and Bill of Rights, you will find both Article 3, creating our judiciary, and the First Amendment that speaks to the cherished protection of freedom of the press. Both are cornerstones of our democracy. They are both complementary at times and also at times decidedly adversarial. That's the way the system works. Our goal today is to explore both the complementary and the adversarial aspects of this relationship in a way that is beneficial to both the third branch and the fourth estate, and ultimately to the people. Because that's really fundamentally what this exercise is about. Because if we understand each other better and we communicate better, I think that it leads to, among other things, a better informed populace, more civic education, all the things that cause citizens to be engaged and better members of society. One of the hallmarks of the Clark Forum is that Dickinson students play an integral role in its programs. It is fitting, then, that we have with us the Clark's Student Project Supervisor, Senior Katie Stewart. Katie, come on up. Katie's going to introduce our very distinguished panelists today, and following that, our most distinguished moderator, Katie.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Katie Stewart, and I'm Student Project Supervisor at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clark Forum and the Pennsylvania Commission on Judicial Independence, I would like to welcome you to today's panel discussion, The Third Branch Meets the Fourth Estate. We are grateful to have with us today six judges, six representatives of the press, and three academics to discuss the interaction of the judicial branch and the media in the United States. I will now introduce our panelists. Representing the judiciary are the Honorable Marjorie Rendell, Judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. The Honorable Darnell Jones, U.S. District Judge of the Eastern District of Pennsylvania. The Honorable Ronald Castile, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania. The Honorable Kate Ford Elliott, President Judge of the Superior Court of Pennsylvania. The Honorable Richard Lewis, President Judge of the Court of Common Pleas of Dauphin County. And the Honorable Skip Ebert, Judge of the Court of Common Pleas of Cumberland County. Members of the media who are with us today are Hank Greslack, Editor-in-Chief of the Legal Intelligencer. William Marimo, Editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer. David Newhouse, Executive Editor of the Patriot News Company. Mark Scalforo, Reporter for the Associated Press. Joseph Slobogin, Staff Writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And Lillian Thomas, City Editor for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Finally, our panelists from the academic community are Professor John Gedded, Director of the Law and Government Institute of the Widener Law School. Professor Ken Gormley, Interim Dean of the Duquesne University School of Law, and Dickinson's own Professor Stephanie Larson of the Political Science Department. At this time, I would like to remind you to please turn off all cell phones and electronic devices. Additionally, I would like to invite you to attend a reception in the front lobby. Lillian Thomas. Pittsburgh Post. Additionally, I'd like to invite you to attend a reception in the front lobby following the conclusion of the discussion. Our moderator this afternoon is Professor John Curley of the Pennsylvania State University. He is a Dickinson graduate and has won distinguished alumni awards from both Dickinson College and the Columbia University School of Journalism. Professor Curley worked for Gannett News Service for more than 30 years and was the first editor of USA Today. Thank you, and please join me in welcoming Professor John Curley.
Thank you. We're going to try to cover a wide range of topics, which both groups and the academics who are scholarly in their approach can comment on. And I think I'll begin with something that's across both groups of the press and the courts. It's been referred to several times that with media dropping in numbers in terms of reporters, editors, and judges increasing in needs for having the courts covered so that the public can get exposed to issues, that we seem to have an issue here of what gets covered and what doesn't. How are relations right now between the two groups? Are things going well? Is there commentary on either side to get more coverage? I'm going to start with Hank Greslack, who's pretty close to the issues at the Legal Intelligencer.
I mean, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. We're in kind of a unique position since we're a legal newspaper. I think to some degree, I found typically the judges are very suspicious of journalists to start. I think because we tend to have a more specialized knowledge and we tend to be a little more academic in some of the stuff we cover, I think we have an easier time gaining their trust. So from my perspective, individually and from our staff's point of view, I think it's been pretty good. I think the relationship's been pretty good. There have been rough times at other times. However, what I will say generally is when I talk to judges or when I approach a judge for the first time, I find that they're very, very cautious, very nervous, sometimes combative. And I think, you know, it's like anything, and the journalists can speak to this too. I mean, it's like it's like establishing any rapport with a potential source. You have to gain a level of trust. There has to be mutual respect. And one thing that I always encourage judges to do is that I don't think it's a bad thing to talk to journalists. I think you should do it. I think you should develop a level of trust with somebody and work with them. And what I mean by work with them is you can go off the record. You can, you know, one of the things that judges that I speak with do all the time with me is if they have a problem, they'll tell me. You know, it helps educate me. As a journalist, every time you talk to a source, that's a potential education session. It's not just about grabbing news. It's about learning something. And I think for judges, I think they can have a better chance of educating journalists on how to cover them by developing that relationship. But it's also a matter of trust, and it's something that takes time. So, you know, from my point of view, I think judges should be open to it, based on the person, the individual that comes to them. And for journalists, I would suggest reach out to judges. Try to gain their trust. Try to talk to them.
Thanks. Judge Rendell, if you get a call from your colleague there, would you take it? If you don't know him, I know you know him, but if you didn't, would you take that call?
It depends.
And you go off the record with them?
Yeah, I know enough to go off the record and know to do that, you know, when I want to say something that isn't going to be reported. But, you know, your question about relationship, I don't know that there really is a relationship. And I think most judges feel that way. I think judges are wary of the press for fear of getting burned, for fear of the comment that they're giving being taken out of context and kind of popularizing the law in a way that I think most judges are reluctant to do. But on the other hand, I do agree that we have a role, we all have a role of educating the public. And I think we as judges should take that to heart. and realize that the public perception of the courts is only as good as the education that we can give the public about the courts. And if we don't, if we aren't forthcoming with kind of helping to explain an opinion or helping educate the public, then we have only ourselves to blame. But I know that the drill is the call comes in and it's no comment. And I don't know how to bridge that gap. I don't know how the media could say to us, listen, I really just want to run by what I plan to say and have you tell me if I've gotten the opinion right or not. In fact, I had a case where I think it was somebody from the AP called me. Well, we had a case, CBS versus FCC. It was the Janet Jackson 9/16th of a second wardrobe malfunction. And it was a very esoteric, it was a very complicated issue. And the reporter said, this is how I want to characterize what was said. And I said, well, and I helped her work through it. And by doing that, probably got the story to be more accurate and got the public to understand exactly what was being decided. But there is this instant reaction of no comment. It's so much easier. It's so much easier for judges not to comment. And I think educating judges that the better thing to do is to help the media get it right, I think that would be a positive move.
Any judges have been burned or know anything about judges who have been, Judge Ford Elliott?
Well, I don't know about burned. I was just thinking that it's such a different relationship, I think, that exists between the trial judge, who perhaps has a reporter sitting in a courtroom on a daily basis or covers the courthouse and gets to know the judge. And I think that there is the opportunity at that point to develop a kind of relationship that Hank was talking about. It's a little different at the appellate level because we don't have that kind of contact generally. And what I have found that has helped us tremendously, because appellate courts do hand down very controversial decisions, and they have a broad impact on a statewide basis, is having a public information officer or a public information team that works for the court system. And I think that's where the relationship can become very critical between the public information officers and the reporters who may need additional information. I know one of the best recommendations that's given to me by our public information people at the AOPC, at the Pennsylvania Administrative Office, was have a reporter send you email questions. And what that does is not only help you to better frame your answer, but it also locks the reporter into some degree in terms of what is actually going to end up being reported.
Joe Slobosian from the Philadelphia Inquirer, you're in the courts as much as the justices are, I think. What's been your experience over the years?
Well, I think it's kind of difficult to come up with a broad generalization. My experience has been that judges are generally pretty open to my approach with them with a question, depending on how articulate I am in asking that question, and that makes the biggest difference. The other thing is about journalists is that we earn our credibility one story at a time. The reason I think that judges have been willing to speak with me and a lot of other journalists who have written about the courts for some time is that we have a track record. They know that most of the time what I write is accurate, it's fair. If there's a reason to go to a judge for comment, I make the effort. And that establishes some level of trust, even with judges that I don't speak with on a regular basis. It's just you have a track record to work with. But I've found, most of the time, I've had judges call to me without me calling them, just saying, I like what you write. If you ever need to have a question answered or have something explained, give me a call.
Judge Lewis, have you had any issues in this area? You've been a DA before you were a judge, so you've got a wide range of experience.
Well, that transition from the district attorney ranks into sitting as a judge, and the same transition that Judge Ebert had, made it a bit easier because as a district attorney, you're dealing with the press almost 24/7, and you establish those relationships with the local media. And transitioning into a judge, you know who you can talk to, who will respect the fact that you can't give out too much information. You may be able to comment on background and so forth. So that trust is there, and I think that came in very handy for me.
Professor Gedded?
It's interesting. We must get 3, 4, 5 phone calls a week from reporters. And I know what's happened with me is there are reporters I won't talk to because they want just to hear, and there aren't that many, they want to hear only what they need, one line out of context to make a story. And there are others who call who don't understand a complex appellate decision or don't understand the constitutional or other law that is involved and are trying to learn. And I and my colleagues will spend hours with them. And the stories come out much better because they have learned. And I think that what has happened with the legal intelligencer is part of that same syndrome. You've learned law, and you have a slightly easier time with the judges who know it.
Chief Justice. One of the problems with judges commenting to the press or speaking out about these cases is that there is a specific rule in the judicial canons which control or guide a judge in their everyday work about not commenting on a pending case. That's a prescription that can get a certain judge in trouble depending on how they comment on the case itself. And most judges don't want to appear in front of the Judicial Conduct Board, or the Court of Judicial Discipline, which in this state has the ability to take your robe away from you. So there is that lingering over the entire situation. And judges feel like they're sometimes we're the third branch of government, but we're so small that the feeling is that we're like in a fraternity together. So the attack on one is sometimes perceived as an attack on the rest of the judges, which sometimes makes them reluctant, even on a personal basis, to want to deal with certain things in the press.
Do you have any advice on this topic for the press?
Just report it accurately. And there's a lot of individuals out there who are willing to say scurrilous things about any particular case. So you can't just be one-sided in the case. And most of the journalists that I know will report both sides to try and make it even-handed. So a lot of times, though, you'll hear it from one side of a case, one of the litigants, but the judge, you know, the canons of judicial conduct won't reply on it. So sometimes we have to depend on surrogates like Professor Gedded and Professor Gormley to explain things where a judge themselves may not want to.
I've had interest on this topic from 3 more people, and I will take them, and then we'll move on. Stephanie Larson of Dickinson College.
I guess I just wanted to point out that media is a plural, not a singular world. And so when we talk about reporters, we can't pretend that they're all the same. And I'm not talking about ideological bias, which is exaggerated. I'm talking more about experience, the needs of that media. So here we have all print and wire reporters, and they're going to probably know a lot more about the court and understand it coming in the door better than a lot of television reporters or local news covering local courts. And different people are going to know more or less. And what we're finding, even at the Supreme Court level, is that over time, there's been fewer reporters that are there full-time that have that experience beforehand to really understand that case. And we can't expect our judges to have 2 jobs, educators of the press and judges, you know, doing the work of a judge. So we have these public information officers in between. State courts, only about half of the states do that. But in the federal level, we have much more of that. But reporters often come to them wanting spin, because that's what reporters who are not particular court reporters, and those are fewer and fewer, more expensive, need legal training. They want to know the spin, because they're used to putting a story together, not understanding much of anything, but having somebody on the Democratic side say, oh, that's great, and someone on the Republican side say, oh, that's awful, and putting them together on TV. And the court's not going to play that game for good reason. And public information officers are a no-spin zone. And it's like, here's a lot of information. Make some sense of it. And that's not how a lot of reporters are trained. And when you think, like right now, we only have one network that actually has a full-time reporter at the Supreme Court. and that's NBC, and it's just shriveled down. So we can get some great reporting from, like, the New York Times with, you know, Linda Greenhouse, but we're not going to get much at a lot of other places.
Lillian Thomas, you wanted to comment on this topic.
I was just going back to what Justice Castile said, and we, our reporters, also build on relationships, which I think is what we're all talking about here. If you know the issues and know the judge, oftentimes we go to the judges after everything is over to try to get that opinion or to have them look back, but look to other people during the cases. But I just wanted to add one more thing, and I think where we often find stumbling blocks are not individual reporters and individual judges, but rather policy, court policy. We've been at loggerheads with the Common Pleas in Allegheny County over a very restrictive photographic policy. And we don't think photos are the center of the world. We think that explaining the story is more important, but pictures help. And so sometimes it's more a big administrative level decision as opposed to individual reporters and judges that I think cause problems.
We'll come back to that topic in a bit. But Mark Scalfaro from the Associated Press.
Well, yeah, I agree. I don't think the issue that judges are in much danger of getting many reporters calling them to ask them to comment about a particular case, because we've all been down that road and judges just don't do that. But I think that it would be helpful if judges would take more of a look at the policies they set and whether or not they have any specific goal in mind, and if they harm, if they tend to help or harm our goal, which is to try to understand what happened and tell it to people. For example, judges, when the jury is let out, I've seen judges say to the jurors, you know, look, reporters are going to try to contact you. You don't have to talk to them. And the tone in which they say that sometimes, it can be unmistakable. The tone is, I don't think you ought to talk to him. Now, is that a judge's role, and does that really further anything? You know, is there a legitimate, you know, judicial goal that's achieved in doing that? You know, I'd suggest maybe there isn't. I know there are courthouses in central Pennsylvania where you can't get a camera in the front door. Others that allow you in the hallway. There's a separate issue about, I know there's a ban on cameras and video cameras in the courtrooms, but you know, what's the objective here that they're trying to achieve by having, you know, television camera people and photographers shivering in the cold outside, you know, and the people we need to talk to going out different doors? I mean, does that really do anyone any good except make our job more difficult? You know, there are similar policies having to do with cell phones in the courtroom, you know, laptops in the courtroom. These may seem like, you know, the last thing a judge ought to be worried about, but if your goal is to, you know, to help the press get it right and to tell people what happened inside, these are things that would help us. I don't think there's any, you know, it's any skin off the nose of the judge, but, you know, from courthouse to courthouse or judge to judge, that the practices can be very different and make a tremendous amount of difference to us.
We've touched on cameras a couple times, both the still or the just trying to get access, and we've talked about the cameras in the courtroom, and let's go there for a second. Judge Elliott, Judge Ford Elliott, how have cameras worked in your level? You've got them. Other parts of Pennsylvania don't have them.
And we have, we only allow cameras in the courtroom, and it's really only the Pennsylvania Cable Network for our court and bank sessions, which are the sessions which are nine judges who rehear cases. And they're usually before the court and bank because they are very important cases for people all across Pennsylvania. So we have, over the last 10 years, allowed our court and bank sessions to be recorded. And to be honest, it has been, I think, a very worthwhile project. It is amazing to me that as many people watch those sessions as they do. I think Commonwealth Court has now started to do it. And it's, you know, it's interesting to go into a supermarket and be in a shopping line and someone says, I just saw you on television last night. And then you realize that there is an impact to all of this. But it also, I think, helps the court to be a lot better prepared. When they know they're going to be on camera, they're going to make sure our panels always are prepared, but we make sure that we're a little more articulate in our questioning and that type of thing.
Sounds good. Chief Judge Castile, your court doesn't permit that, and what do you think on that subject? Is there a way to go to get that done or not?
We traditionally, all the courts have traditionally not, in this state at least, have not allowed cameras. The Commonwealth Court and the Superior Court are the first two courts where we allow them actually inside. And those are appellate courts where there's seven or nine judges sitting up there. And it's a lot different than a trial court where there's certain things going on. There's witnesses who may not want to be identified. You see it all the time on television from other states. But we haven't gone that far as yet. And, of course, we are looking at the experience of the Commonwealth Court and Judge Fort Elliott's court to determine if we're going to start taping of the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania. And we have had requests for taping to come in. Some justices are for it. Some justices are not for it. We basically need 4 out of 7 votes. But if we're going to do that, we would like to make it unanimous. And I'm sure that'll be under consideration in the next, when the next justice comes in January. There's an election this year. And both of those candidates are from the Superior Court and are used to television. Both of them have made the comment that they think that the Supreme Court ought to televise. And it would be an educational process. It would be a boring educational process.
It's good sleeping pill.
Yeah, they're these sessions are just lawyers arguing before the judges against each, for their particular side. So, yeah, it might be good at 10:30 at night when you're starting to drift off a little bit. This might help you, but we are considering that. We have had formal requests from PCN, and we'll deal with that next year when we have a full complement of elected judges.
Judge Ebert, you're close to home on this one. This is a topic that your people see you on the streets, they see you in court.
I think when I was district attorney, I would have loved him in the courtroom of doing that, but that gives my exact position now as a judge is I don't think there's any place in a trial courtroom for that. There are too many attorneys just pan to that and turn it into another commercial for their firm. And there's enough antics in these courtrooms as it is to add that extra value. I mean, I worry about you talk about the phones. You have these photo phones, and I don't need people popping up and taking pictures of what's going on in the courtroom. It's extremely distracting, and I think we should just stick to the case at hand, let the reporters handle it from interviews, but I don't see any good coming out of having it in the courtrooms here. And I've watched it in other states, and I've been on committees for the ABA, and I'm seriously come to that position.
Dean Gormley, you've got a view on this, I think.
Well, I haven't really made up my mind to tell you the truth, John. I think it's very difficult. Every year I try to take my constitutional law class to an argument in the United States Supreme Court, and I think anyone who's ever sat in that chamber, I still get goosebumps sitting there every time I go after 25 years. And I understand why so many justices of the U.S. Supreme Court think it would destroy the tradition of that court to have cameras. There's something sacred about what goes on in courtrooms. It's not supposed to be for amusement or entertainment. And I do agree with what the judge just said, is that ultimately the goal is to have the work done effectively in the courtroom. And to the extent that cameras start distracting people, and it's no fault of the media, for whom I have great respect, you're not getting the work accomplished, and I'm not sure exactly what you're gaining from that. So I have some real concerns. I think it is good that pilot programs, experimental programs are going on, but I would not be one to leap into it.
As an editor, Mr. Newhouse, do you think cameras should be in the courts?
Well, my reporters have all heard me say that the newspaper is not homework. And we're here in academia, but people who are reading a newspaper or getting their news from other media, they're not obligated to do so. It's our job and it's our passion to inform the public. We have to do it in a way that's responsible, but we also have to do it in a way that communicates to them. And I think there's an irony here to the fact that if what we're talking about is getting the public to better understand the judicial system, which I think we all agree is imperative, but to get the public to understand the judicial system in a kind of sort of ivory tower or academic way it's not going to happen. You have to talk to people in a language that they can hear. Now, I would be the first person, personally speaking, to agree that I have real concerns about video cameras in a trial courtroom for exactly the reasons that Judge Ebert says. I mean, we all watched the OJ trial and the kind of shenanigans that went on there. I think at an appellate level and at the Supreme Court level, it's quite different. And then even at a trial court level, I think there is an overriding public interest, and I would agree with Ms. Thomas, in allowing photographs in a courtroom in some fashion. You know, we all go to photograph rock concerts, and the rock concert organizers give our press photographers 3 minutes at the beginning of their first song to take all their photos. Well, if they can arrange photography at a rock concert in a way that doesn't disturb the rock concert of 20,000 people, I have confidence that the court system can come up with guidelines for allowing us to take photographs in a courtroom that will not disrupt the proceedings.
Judge Jones, you have experience at the state and federal level. Do you have any views on cameras, whether they should be permitted in the courthouses just to take pictures or whether they should be in courtrooms?
My jury's still out. No, I, having been involved in this process as a judge for about the last 22 years and having taught it on numerous occasions, legitimately, there are serious concerns that I harbor regarding exactly what Judge Ebert has indicated. And I say that somewhat cautiously and certainly out of respect to members of the bar. I note when I came out of law school, one thing you would not see would be lawyer advertising. Well, now you see lawyers' pictures on the back of buses and catchy names for law firms and basically guaranteeing victory, which is frankly absurd. If people can do that out there, they will find a way to do it inside the courtroom, and that's what we fear. On the other hand, I like to say I have a triple vested interest in the First Amendment as a citizen, as a member of the judiciary, and as a father who paid tuition to Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism for a daughter who's a TV anchor in Philadelphia. I believe that the public has a right to know, and you know perhaps no better than being in the courtroom, which you have a right to do because it's a public courtroom. On the other hand, every judge, I think, probably fears misquotation, fears the individual who chooses to use what has been said as the antithesis of what really is at issue. In other words, it's all about trust. It's all about having the confidence, just like you want to have the confidence in the judiciary, we want to have confidence in the communicator's ability to portray it accurately. And I don't think if you have cameras in a courtroom, say for an appellate court where there's an argument, if it is a trial court, that you're going to have that kind of accuracy in depicting what really occurred and what this is really all about. Lastly, it's a matter of security. A lot of jurors, a lot of witnesses don't want to have that kind of publicity because of fear. Once they walk out of that courtroom, there's not going to be anyone there to protect them. And frankly, even in terms of the judiciary, there's a serious concern about security as well.
Stephanie Larson, you're a researcher, and I think you may have done some work in this field.
Well, I know of two studies that are relevant to this question of, well, what are they going to do if they've got the video? The first question is, like, how are reporters going to use it? And the second is, how is the public going to respond to more of that information having, you know, is it going to be educational or not? And the first one was in a state court in New York where it was a high-interest case in New York City where police had killed misidentified suspect who ended up, you know, wrong person, wrong place. And they had the cameras in the courtroom, and what they found is the television stations that were covering that, only 22% of that coverage included the video that was there. And when that video was included, it wasn't allowed to speak for itself, which we should kind of know about television, right? Instead, it was sound bit to death, you know, little tiny clips out of context that seemed the most visually appealing. And so mostly had reporters talking over the video and the video being used in ways that kind of fit the entertainment needs of local news. not a good lesson, okay? The second one is that with the Supreme Court, they never let cameras in the courtroom, but they do release audio tapes of oral arguments, usually at the end of the term. Twice they've done it immediately, with Bush v. Gore and then University of Michigan affirmative action case. And there was a study out in the field during the Bush v. Gore one where they had polled people beforehand and then polled them afterwards. And they did find that there was some educational value to this, that an increased percentage of people could identify the Chief Justice, which is a little strange because he wasn't that involved. But, I mean, it went from, like, 16% knew his name beforehand to 31% knew his name afterwards. Okay. However, on the other side, when they looked at trust in the court and confidence in the court, Republicans' confidence grew. Democrats' confidence went down. Independent, middle-of-the-road people, no change. But to have the opinions of the court, the confidence in the court as an institution, correlated with partisanship is troubling. And so I thought that that was more of a finding that would say, beware, because that's going to be used in a way that is going to fit, again, the paradigm and the norms of the media institution, and then be received in a way by an audience that's a pretty lay audience in a way that's going to reinforce certain things. So part of why the court has had more respect all these years in public opinion polls than the other political institutions, I think, might be because of that distance. And to make that distance, shrivel it, at least this case sort of indicates it might have a backfire.
Joe Slobosian?
Well, I wanted to say, in Philadelphia in federal court, and I'm not sure how common this is, but the radio stations all the time take audio tapes of trials, oral arguments, testimony in the federal court, and it goes on the air on radio, KYW, some of the other stations. I don't know from the court perspective what their opinion is of that. I haven't seen any real problem from the public's perception. I mean, it becomes a voice clip, a voice cut that gets used on the air, just as I would quote a witness or a judge in the newspaper the next day. It has a little bit more immediacy because you have a human voice behind the quote. But this has been going on for probably 3 or 4 years now.
Judge Rendell and Judge Jones, is there a court view on this? The KYW All News?
What you're talking to or talking about is mainly in the trial courts.
Right.
We don't see it that much in the Court of Appeals. And quite frankly, as Chief Justice Castile said, try to get a snapshot of an argument in the Court of Appeals. The complexity, by the time you get there, and the same thing with, I'm sure, the appellate state courts, there are no good sound bites from these arguments. And they are available. All of our arguments are immediately available, and I know the Supreme Court arguments, I just read one the other day, you can print them out instantly. So the access is there for anyone who wants to find it from the Court of Appeals standpoint. And watching three judges sit there and argue back and forth with lawyers, it's better to read the transcript, believe me, than to watch the appeals. But I don't know of any policy vis-a-vis the trial courts and the federal court with that kind of reporting.
I should say also that I covered the only trial in Philadelphia that was ever videotaped, and that was the late Judge Gothrop, who I believe was a Dickinson alumnus, and it was the Doe case, the Philadelphia attorney who was HIV positive and was fired, and it came out shortly after the movie Philadelphia. The trial took place, and there was a lot of controversy about it. I don't know that the video availability made any difference in the verdict or in the public perception. But of course, I think, again, it depends on the judge. Judge Gothrop ran a pretty tight show in his courtroom, and lawyers who were trying to play to the camera, he took care of it pretty quickly. But again, it's almost it's unusual now because it was an experiment and it never was repeated.
Bill Marimow, I saw you wanted to comment, the editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer.
My view is this is a balancing act, and on one side is the public's right of access, the maximum number of people to really see the way justice is administered at trial courts, appellate courts, and the Supreme Court versus a judge's view of conducting an orderly courtroom. My feeling is a lot of the judge's reservations could be overcome, such as not having video of any of the jurors. To my mind, that's not critical, and other rules. But I feel like the courts, just like the city council, ought to be a place where tens of thousands of citizens can see how it happens, with all of the unruliness and arguments and boredom and ennui. So I come down strongly on letting tens of thousands of people see how it happens and having the judges impose order through rules and their own regulations.
Let me ask you a question beyond that. There have been some comments about the reduced coverage in the courts because of money. Is that happening at places like the Philadelphia Inquirer?
Lamentably, it's happening at most news organizations. Our view is that when there are major trials and major cases, we are going to be purposefully inefficient. The best example would be the recent political corruption trial of State Senator Fumo. In that case, we assigned two reporters, both veterans, Emily Lonsbury and Craig McCoy, to the courtroom every day. One of them was there to do the daily story for the newspaper. The second was there to look for an analytical story for the Sunday paper. And then we assigned a third reporter, Bob Moran, to do a blog. And the idea of the blog was every 10, 15, or 20 minutes, Bob Moran would say exactly what was happening. One paragraph, two paragraphs, to be as accurate and thorough and fair as he could, but also to be immediate. And many of the people that I covered, when I covered the courts, lawyers now and judges, told me that in many law offices, their computers were tuned to Philly.com from 10 in the morning till 5 at night. So my view is that the courts ought to be covered round the clock, federal and state courts and appellate courts, and resources have stretched our ability to do it. But when the occasion requires it, we'll do it.
Was there any negative fallout? You cited the positive fallout. Did you get any court fallout from anywhere or anybody else?
Actually, John, the answer is no. I've had federal judges whom I know socially say to me that that was really laudable. Attorneys, both former prosecutors and defense attorneys, really loved what we did. In my opinion, the Inquirer's coverage really raised very significant issues, not only of lawyer ethics, but also political ethics. And to me, that is what a press should be doing, giving the public information of governing importance.
Okay, Judge Eber.
I like that idea about 10,000 people watching a trial. They ought to watch it then from the moment it begins to the moment it ends. Not focus then on the rape victim who gets asked questions, which I cannot control, are legitimate questions like, tell me the color of his underwear at that stage. Now, to have that a victim on TV, and that will be the only thing that's seen on the 6 o'clock news when she says, I don't remember, is not right. If you're going to watch the entire trial and it goes on like PCN, we're going to start this trial and watch, and nothing gets significantly picked out to pick on victims, and I have to give the media credit for this. I'll bet you that question usually isn't even reported, but it is incredibly humiliated. It's a legitimate question to say, well, she doesn't have a recall of that. Why, she must be not telling the truth. And that's the balance that also has to be drawn here. And you know, and I know, that 10,000 people are not going to watch a trial of retail theft or anything else. They'll focus in on the sensational murders and the sex crimes, and that's what will get attention.
Well, just to respond, the Inquirer and most news organizations never identify victims of alleged sexual crimes. So we wouldn't be covering a rape trial because we'd never identify a victim. And then I think all of you judges are quite erudite and could figure out how to circumscribe a case like that. The Inquirer would never identify the victim of a sexual crime.
David Newhouse? Does the Patriot News do blogging in courts?
Well, we do not. Most courts do not allow the kind of equipment inside to allow blogging. I think the issue of resources is a real issue, and I think that's an issue where I say regrettably, because it's unfortunate that we have that problem. Regrettably, judges and the press find themselves on the same side of the issue. I know we've had conversations with Judge Jones and some of the other Middle District federal judges about trying to have enough coverage, the coverage that we'd like and they would like of federal courts. I just want to harken back, though, to one of the things that that we open with that I think can help with this. When we were talking about relationships between the press and the courts, you know, we were focusing on reporters calling judges for comments outside of after cases were decided and that kind of thing. But on a practical day-to-day basis, one of the most helpful things that we can have is for our reporters to have good relationships with the judges and with the judges' staffs, as we have, for example, with Judge Lewis and with Judge Ebert's staff, to really and Judge Jones' staff, to really try to guide us into, we can't cover everything, but what are the important cases? And sometimes not even the important cases, sometimes just the interesting cases, and to try to maximize our resources that way.
Judge Rendell, what do you think on this general topic of the Internet in court?
The Internet in court.
Well, bloggers. And there are different levels of bloggers. On one hand, you get reporters who are, you know, accredited and with the news agencies and the newspapers. And then you get people that just want to blog. And then you've got the possibility of jurors getting into the act.
Well, it's very tough to regulate. Number one, it's protected by the First Amendment, so it should be tough to regulate. But you wonder where it's heading and where it's going to end. But I do think that you know, we're confronting all of these communication devices, and all of this kind of knowledge is out there. But there's a lot of reckless knowledge and a lot of things that are not educationally sound. But you wonder, you know, how do you control things of this kind? I mean, under our Constitution, there is the right to free speech. And you're getting then beyond the Fourth Estate. You're getting beyond people who had the ethics that journalists have, and you're getting out into the realm that really isn't controllable. And I think that's dangerous. But I'm at a loss to figure exactly how you regulate it. It's interesting. You talk to a lot of high school students, and they are on Facebook, and they're very upset that people can see what's on Facebook, and they think there's this right to privacy in Facebook, and you know, how long do we need to have this lesson in what the right of privacy really is, and that, you know, when communication is out there, it's out there. And I think we, you know, need to educate people as to what the logical results are of the proliferation of communication. But in terms of regulation, it's going to be very tough to do anything about it.
True. Dean Gormley?
No, I have not formed a final opinion on that as well, and I agree with what Judge Rendell said. I think that it is hard to control. There is a right of free speech, but there is a right to, you know, you have to be responsible for abuses thereof under the Pennsylvania Constitution anyway. I think it's very complicated. I think when you're talking about jurors, such as the case with Senator Fumo's trial, those kinds of things are very problematic if you start envisioning jurors letting everyone know in advance what the verdict might be. And that isn't the case in that case, but there were concerns. I think if you have people in the courtroom, I started my career clerking for a federal judge, and he used to lean down at me and say periodically, "Kenny, tell that man to take the pipe out of his mouth." But you can be distracted so easily when you're running a trial, and if everyone's there, you know, clicking away and doing, you know, using their BlackBerries or whatever, I think that's also disruptive. So, again, I think it's very important to allow the Fourth Estate, the media, to report accurately, and I think there probably are ways to control that and to allow journalists to start using this new technology to report from the courtroom, but I think there have to be ways to control it so that it's just not a free-for-all once you enter the courtroom.
Hank Greslock?
Yeah, I mean, my attitude about this is, you know, in terms of blogging, that kind of stuff, and judges seem to be inconsistent with their policies about laptops. If you want accurate coverage of the trial, let the reporters in with the laptop. As long as they're not disruptive, let them in, because it's a lot easier to sit there, type up aspects of the testimony or aspects of the trial, than write your hand. Look, my handwriting's terrible, okay? I can't even read what I wrote about 20 minutes ago, okay? It's tough to write, transcribe, come back. Then you're in a rush on deadline. To circle back, though, real quick about the TV stuff, I find the whole cameras in the courtroom a superficial debate, because on a practical level, trying to get information out of courts in this state is very inconsistent. And to me, the more important issue in terms of informing the public and having a better knowledge of the court system is access to that information. You know, we keep talking about cameras. It's images. Big deal. To me, the more important thing is case docket information. I mean, there's a scandal going on. We know a corruption probe up in Luzerne County. You can go up there and you can look on the civil side and look up certain parties by name and see every case they've appeared in. You go to criminal, you can't get anything. That's problematic, because when you hear an allegations of stuff, you can't investigate stuff. You don't have access to the information. And if you talk to most reporters from county to county, getting verdict information, sometimes getting even just opinion information is very, very difficult. Some judges, some courts are great. Some are not so great.
Yeah.
And to me, in terms of access to information, informing the public, that's the bigger issue than cameras in the courtroom.
I can come back to access and open records in a second, but Professor?
Just, I want to go move back about half okay. a step. Back to what Judge Ebert said, because it ties into something that Professor Gormley also said. You know, decision-making in a courtroom is based on the whole record, all the evidence. If a judge is the fact finder, if you've got a non-jury trial, it's the judge who has to make the decision based on all the evidence. If it's a jury, it's the jury who looks at the whole picture and comes up with a decision. But institutionally, what the media do is they're trying frequently to summarize or to pick a single issue, and it's diametrically opposed. I'm not certain what the answer is, but the way, Judge Ebert, you're not the first one. You're not the first judge I've heard raise that problem. I've seen it in much of the literature, that there's the concern is the way we make our decisions based on all the evidence. And I'd be interested in knowing what our journalist companions have by way of response to that.
Yeah, Lily?
I think when you said if we really want people to understand what goes on, they have to listen to the whole thing. If we move to a different estate, we wouldn't say that to understand what the state legislature does, you have to sit through, and that would be even worse than sitting into through some of your procedures, I think, sit through the entire 101 days of making the budget to understand the budget. What we try to do is put things into context and to summarize them in some cases, sometimes inaccurately, but that's what we're there for. And I think that if you throw away that idea that you can't understand anything unless you read every document and sit through every minute, then you're not going to be able to educate the public. And I think that in this day of scarce resources, I still have two court reporters who do a lot of daily coverage, who do sit through some trials gavel to gavel. But we can't do that with everything. And I think that we in the media have to do a good job of that, and that's not under everybody's control. But I also think that putting things into context is what we do. 10,000 people aren't going to sit through all those procedures, and they're not going to sit through the state legislature making the budget either.
Back in January, Pennsylvania passed a new open records law that was said to open things up a bit. And there's also the issue of closing courts on petitions that gets into the issue of privacy sometimes when records should be open. Both the Philadelphia and Pittsburgh papers have cases involved where they're challenging some closures of records that they believe should be open based on the new law. Bill, would you like to talk about that for a second?
I can't give you detail after detail, but what I'd say is that it's clear that there's a commitment in Harrisburg to opening up state records under the law. And our experience so far has been the person who is running that office is 100% committed to making sure that the public, not just the press, has access to state records. I think the enforcement at this point is unequal. Not every county government, not every state government agency has really had their consciousness raised, and in fairness, may not have the resources to provide everything on a timely basis. So I'd say there's an improvement, but there's still a gap between what the law says ought to be done and what's happening in the trenches.
Judge Lewis and Judge Ebert, have you seen any challenges at your level in this area yet to come up?
I have not. There have been very few, quote, formal requests because I believe officials are trying to do it. What you just spoke about, though, that's kind of disturbing. Either something's on a docket and it's open or it's not. Short of it being put into a grand jury or some type of order that really held it up, and that's still a judicial ruling, I'd really have to hear about why something that, I mean, we're talking about things that appear on judicial dockets for criminal cases are the filing of charges, the appointment of counsel, just routine types of things. Now, if there, for some reason, that's no longer there and you can't walk into the clerk of courts and say, let me see that docket, that's kind of unusual. I would have a question of that. At our level, it's kind of like, there's so much minutia. I don't, except for some case that has a lot of media appeal, nobody's really interested in, quote, open records because it's very, very routine stuff.
We've had, we've had no challenges to any type of court record. We've had some challenges where suit has been filed with respect to local government. But in all those instances, the matter has been worked out before it resulted in a court hearing.
Okay, good. Chief Judge Castile, some would say you're on the side of the angels in some of these public access cases in that you, for open records, and I know you've got a track record there.
Well, I don't know if I'm on the side of the angels. I used to be in the Marine Corps, so I think that takes me out of the angel category. But we, the judicial branch, we have our own rules for open records, and we've had them, and they predate what the legislature has passed in this last January. We are probably the most open branch of government as we were for sure before last January. Now, the new rules have come in that affect, or the new laws that affect the townships, everyone. So we're dealing with those. But there's some important issues that we have to confront on the open records is how much do you get? Do you get a witness's name that who might be discovered by another gang member, there's security problems. We get at our level, on the statewide level, what we call them data trollers that want to find out everybody who has an arrest warrant issued, and that'll be the request. We want to whoever has had an arrest warrant issued. And they use them sometimes for commercial purposes, to solicit clients, et cetera, et cetera. So we've had problems with things like that. And you get like the, I don't want to call them crazies, but individuals that have these, they want everything, give us everything. And each one of these things is costly to us as a branch of government. You can't just push a button and say, here, you have everything. So there are difficulties with that. And but all of those challenges for the other branches will come up to us. Any challenges to our open records law, open records rules, come up to our open records czar, which happens to be me.
Judge Jones, how do you feel about motions to seal court records? I think some of the papers here have had some issues with that, and where do you see that going?
Well, I've not done it yet on the federal level. On the state level, I did it I believe on two occasions out of 22 years. And I felt that under the circumstances it was justified. I'm sure that there would be people who would sit on the other side of that fence and say, no, it would not be justified. But I did it based upon security reasons, quite frankly, in one case. And in another case, I did it because I thought that it was, frankly, something that promoted a settlement in the case and was going to benefit the plaintiff and benefit the defense in getting the case done. And both sides mutually requested that the matter be sealed, and I sealed it. But as a general rule, I don't seal records. I think that the public has an absolute right to know.
David Newhouse, you have had any issues in this area?
First, I'd like to applaud Judge Jones for his point of view. I wish that the entire judiciary had that same point of view. I think there's two sort of separate issues here. One is sealing court records during proceedings. And it's been our experience, and probably the experience of the other journalists here, that unfortunately that happens too often. And it happens, I mean, the judge can basically do it anytime they want to do it without any clear explanation or guidelines. And this happens far too often by our lights. The second issue is with settlements in civil cases, where settlements are sealed afterwards. And I think we can certainly understand the interest of the judiciary in promoting settlements. On the other hand, you have cases like were uncovered in, I believe it was King County, Washington. The Seattle Times did a tremendous series about settlements that had been sealed afterwards that had a pattern of covering up malpractice and all kinds of other heinous things that frankly, the public had a right to know. So I think the issue is having clear and consistent guidelines for judges to follow, both in terms of during proceedings and in terms of settlements. But I think that the presumption should be that the public should have a right to know, except in those sorts of cases, certainly in terms of security or those kind of things, where there is an issue really of safety and not just an issue of protecting someone's reputation or business prospects.
First, Mr. Gormley, and then Mr. Marimo.
And with respect to having some kind of standards, I think that's a great point. I'm finishing a book right now I've been working on for 9 years on the whole Clinton Star matter, and obviously lots of that material was under seal at different times. Lots of it was leaked to the media, and so it was easy to get access to it. One of the things that has surprised me, and I think people just haven't thought about it, is once something's sealed, how do you unseal it and when? And I've run into a lot of problems of getting material that I think the public does have a right to know because it's still under seal from 10 years ago and no one knows if it's going to be violating some court order still. The judges really have moved on to other things. So I do think it's important not only to figure out when you can seal it, but at what point and how do you unseal it so that the public does have an access to it.
So just very quickly to follow up on that, it's funny you mentioned that because we actually just had a case where a reporter is writing about a case that's 10 years old. It's done. The verdict was delivered 10 years ago. The perpetrator is in prison. And we wanted to review the record on that case, and the judge said it was sealed because of an ongoing investigation. Well, there is no ongoing investigation. They just sealed the record.
Mark?
I just wanted to point out, Chief Justice Castillo may have given the impression that this issue of data trawling is something that that has caused financial problems for the courts. If I'm not mistaken, you charge people for that. Is it, am I right?
Yeah, we've charged per page. But some of these requests have taken up to 100 hours of time of the individuals. It never would have happened before. But, yeah, there is a cost per page for
Well, we're for electronic records. I know we've paid AOPC a couple of times to for the cost of personnel time. That's not standard for these kinds.
No,
of
if it is a these type of requests that use a lot of time of our individuals, we will try and save the taxpayers money by having the requester help fund it. Although I think on the open records law, the one that was passed, you can't charge them anything except 25 cents a page or whatever they have in the statute.
But does that apply to the judicial branch?
No, it doesn't really, because we're the third. Our branch of government's ruled by the Article 5 of the Constitution, which gives us control over the procedures and practice of the law in the state of Pennsylvania. So we're not immune to that law, but we certainly look to Harrisburg to see which way the wind blows. Of course, Harrisburg looked to us because we had to. Most open records law in the whole state. But there are consequences to that. If you wanted to get certain records now, they still have everyone's Social Security numbers on them. So you would have to go back and log out or black out every Social Security number in the records if you wanted a mass production. And there's 67 different counties that probably have 67 different forms for filing. So some of these things, there are security problems with them, and some of them can be very costly and take up a lot of staff time to comply, but we do try to comply.
Bill?
Oftentimes, both at the federal level and the state level, there's really a gulf between what the law says and reality. And I wanted to give everyone one case because I thought this was a classic story in the public interest. Our transit writer, Paul Nussbaum, wanted to do a story about the condition and safety of Amtrak bridges in Philadelphia and the suburbs. And he filed a Freedom of Information Act request with Amtrak. This was about a year ago. Amtrak replied that based on national security, none of these records could be provided. Paul and I talked about the cost of retaining our law firm, Dilworth, to help unpry the records, and I decided that it was going to cost tens of thousands of dollars. So Paul made himself an expert on the Freedom of Information Act. He filed an appeal. He eventually had a lawyer help prepare a complaint. And at the time the complaint was sent to Amtrak, suddenly all the records were given to us overnight. And there was no national security issue. And about a month ago on a Sunday, Paul did a story that was about a page and a half of the Inquirer with detailed information on the condition of the bridges, explaining in very lucid, non-alarming language what needed to be done. And to me, that was a classic use of the open records law. But it was also a classic case of government deterrence. And then, last but not least, some of you, well, most of you my age, will remember the great Pentagon Papers case that came to the U.S. Supreme Court in 1970. And the Attorney General at the time, John Mitchell, argued fervently that releasing these papers would be a breach of national security that would jeopardize our soldiers in Vietnam. 20 years later, after the Pentagon Papers, Irwin Griswold, who was the Solicitor General of the United States, who argued the Pentagon Papers case on behalf of the Nixon administration, wrote a story for the Washington Post saying that, in fact, there was no national security issues whatsoever, and that he, as a lawyer, had to use every bit of ingenuity and creativity to even make an arguable case. And if anyone wants to read that, I'm sure the attorneys in this room would. It's the Washington Post, Irwin Griswold. You can check it out on LexisNexis. No issues of national security at all.
I'm going to raise a question that involves election of judges. Pennsylvania is an elected state. Of course, at the federal level, there are appointments. But every once in a while, it gets played out as to whether Pennsylvania should go in some combination to appointed and elected. I'm going to ask an academic, John Getta, to talk first about that topic. Where do you think it should wind up? Should it stay the way it is? Are judges close to home, like county judges, electable in a sense that the people know them? Whereas if you go statewide, it's a really, really tough situation.
At the local level, I think judges ought to be elected as they are now. At the appellate level, there are a number of problems. Most people have no idea what the record of the judges is or even what it is that appellate judges do. So there is an argument for some sort of appointive process for the appellate judges. The problem is, however, and I have not been able to work this out, I'm like Ken Gormley, I'm of two minds on this issue, and I simply cannot decide. How do you keep it from becoming totally politicized? How do you keep that point of process from becoming some sort of patronage system? And if someone could answer that one for me, I would be ready to seriously consider an appointive system.
At the risk of just raising one side or the other, what would be wrong with cutting a deal that for one Democrat there'd be one Republican?
Actually, that's what they do in Delaware, I
believe.
And
New Jersey.
And New Jersey.
Right.
That would balance things out.
Two states, I believe.
That would balance things out.
Why should the two parties be doing the selecting?
Well, they're doing it anyway, so.
Why should it be institutionalized?
But you think the people can do a good job statewide?
Well, independents could be elected.
Any newspapers weighed in on this topic?
I mean, we've covered it for a long time. Lynn Marks from Pennsylvania Vermont Courts is here somewhere. She'll probably kill me for saying this. I mean, I've gone back and forth on this. In theory, I think merit selection is a great idea, but this being Pennsylvania, yeah, and we see how politicized things are and how some of the machinations work, I don't know that I have a lot of confidence in it. At the same time, when you look at the election of judges and you look at the who's right, to me, it's not so much even about the public not understanding the candidates, it's about the money behind them. You know, and look where most of the money comes from, lawyers. And there may be nothing going on, or there may be something going on, and it creates appearance problems. You have situations where, you know, people have raised a lot of money, or a PAC has raised a lot of money for a particular judge, and then those people appear before them. I think that's, you know, I mean, it creates appearance problems, and then that erodes public confidence, because people have, whether or not there's any bias or favoritism, people have a belief in that. I hate to sound wishy-washy, because I'm usually not on this kind of stuff, but I don't know what the solution is. I don't know what the solution is. I do think on the appellate level that a lot of times people don't know who the candidates are. But I also think to some degree that's the fault of news organizations, including my own to some degree. I don't think we do a good enough job in this state of covering appellate elections. I don't think we do enough substantive coverage.
Let's segue there. Does the media, the press particularly, have a job to help educate when the Chief Justice only has a 15% recognition rating? And, you know, it's just tough to get name recognition statewide. Should the media do more, and if so, how?
I would just start off by saying, yes, they should, and they do. It's hard to educate the citizens on the, you know, just who is whom and what their backgrounds are. And these voter guides that the newspapers put out and the civic organizations that are interested in that and the bar associations are extremely helpful, in my view, to getting the message out to who the individual is that they're trying to vote for. Unfortunately, I don't think they're widely read. And they're usually only read by individuals that are interested in the election. And these elections tend to be very low level compared to a number turnout compared to a governor or president. It drops off dramatically to less than 30%. So I think the media is extremely important in getting the message out.
Yes. The Associated Press did a package last week on the statewide elections. They got good play in some of the papers that I looked through. You have any thoughts on this, Mark?
Well, I would just say one of the challenges with covering those judicial races is that the candidates try to be judge-like, and there is not sort of like the sharp elbows that you get in almost any other kind of election. It's hard to pin them down about, you know, how are you different from the other person? Even in the wake of this Minnesota case that in theory should have opened up some of the judicial candidates to more discussion of issues or, you know, they're very reluctant to talk about anything that might conceivably come before them. So you end up with like a resume, the Bar Association ratings, and, you know, maybe a quote from a forum. The debate, the forums they have I hate to say it, but they can be deadly. And it just is not it's not a campaign in any recognizable sense. I mean, I think you could get more, you could have more fun following your local borough election than a Pennsylvania appellate court election. Is that the fault of the press? I mean, I don't think so. We have to sort of cover what goes on. And if what goes on is a very vanilla feeling debate, then that's what ends up in the story.
Lillian?
I was just going to say, in years past, we had bigger election guides than we do now, and we've gone more online. And I just, it was always so discouraging because it was so time-consuming to put those together and to still see that judges, the way people voted was often on name recognition or just...
Geographic.
It was very discouraging. And I don't know what the answer to that is because... We, I think, are pretty thorough, and now even though we don't have a tab election guide that we used to have, we have lots of information online, but I don't know. Could someone tell you, could the average reader tell you what the Commonwealth Court does? I don't think so, much less who the candidates are.
What do we do about it? Anything?
Get them out there more, interview them?
I'm not sure. Interesting. I've been through this a few times, and it is sort of interesting because this is one area, I think, where the press could add so much to just the area of public education and recognizing that it is difficult to cover a judicial race. It's particularly difficult for incumbents or judges, sitting judges, to run because not only are they not inclined to talk about issues that may come before them, they've got tons of issues that already are before them. So it's extremely difficult to do that. And there isn't any way to make a judicial election sexy. I mean, I know when I ran once, there was and it turned out to be a canceled election, but I was running in a year for the state superior court when the presidential race was ongoing and there were all of the state row offices up, and everywhere I went, there were crowds of people and rallies, and oh my goodness, the attention was unbelievable. And then, of course, when I had to run the next year after a case decision had called the election off, there was nobody out there. You couldn't even talk to anybody. You'd call up even small town newspapers and say, I'm coming through. May I come in and visit and do an interview? And they'd say, well, we're not really doing judicial candidates. You know, we're not going to talk to you. And it is difficult because then it does require the candidates to go out and raise a great deal more money from sources that they're not comfortable with. And then it also is forcing judicial candidates to run elections very much the same as everybody else runs them. And that is to hire media consultants to find that little glitch in somebody's armor to do a negative ad. It allows for special interest money to come in from outside the state and start to run negative advertisements and spend a great deal of money that the candidates very often don't have any control over. So this is sort of an area where I would say to the newspapers, maybe it's not sexy, but maybe this is part of the overall civics education responsibility that the media has to take on, whether they like it or not, just because of how important this whole area is.
And John, these elections are becoming more partisan because certain factions go to the legislature and they can't get what they want in the legislature, so they will tend to put a lot of money behind a Supreme Court justice who they believe will be amenable to their particular cause. And you see some of these Supreme Court elections in some of these states. Our state just had two elected justices, four candidates. They spent $6 million. Wisconsin just spent $6 million on one seat. Ohio spent $12 million. And most of it's funded by special interest groups or individuals who have a certain pet peeve or something that they're pushing and thinking that they can win that in the judicial branch rather than the executive or the legislative branch. And what it comes down to is when you generally poll people, they say, do you think that a judge would favor a candidate who gave him $1 million? And about 85% of the voters at a poll, people polled, will say yes. And that is a perception of justice that is really corrosive and dangerous, that I think. So the money is the real huge issue.
Judge Jones, you've had opportunities to run, I guess, historically. You'd like to comment on this area?
No.
One up and one down. Huh? You're in favor of appointments? Okay.
I'll say this. And try to be very even-handed about this. Having gone through the nomination process for a federal judgeship, the vetting process is unbelievable. I had to give information from the day I turned 18, where I lived, where I worked, everywhere, all the way to the present time. The bar associations, lawyers, people were calling me from Hawaii saying the FBI called, doing a background check on you. It's a vetting process that I do believe can allow for people, and I say this particularly because of the students in this room, doing your work and committing yourself to an excellent reputation and putting the time in, it's worth it. There is gold at the end of that rainbow. To campaign, particularly statewide, to be a judge on the appellate courts requires you to go to virtually every nook and cranny of this Commonwealth, and you would never ever otherwise get to meet people out there but for that process. I hope that's fair enough to say for both sides.
Dean Gormley.
Yeah, John, I just think there's one thing I'd like to say, because this is sponsored by the Commission on Judicial Independence, and this topic relates back to the topic you started with, and I think it's just important to say the judicial branch is different than the other two branches of government, and a lot of people don't realize that. If you're the governor, if you're Ed Rendell, you have thrown yourself into the political process. If you're a legislator, you have done the same thing. Yeah. Judges, under our system of government, and that's been true since the founding of this nation, are not supposed to be political, even if they're elected. And so I don't care if we have an elected system or an appointed system. It is essential for others, like, as the chief said, the Bar Association leaders and other leaders of the community, to speak in many cases and to deal with a lot of the issues that come up. Because we don't want a judiciary that is acting like a political creature. And I think that it's really difficult for people at times to understand it. But in the recent confirmation hearings having to do with Supreme Court nominees, there have been lots of analogies to the umpire. You know, we call balls and strikes, or the referee. Well, think about if you had an umpire or a referee and you were shining bright lights on them and asking them, why did you call that ball? What exactly were you thinking? After a while, you would start impacting their ability to make correct decisions. A good day for a judge, they're not rock stars. A good day is when no one in the world knows who they are walking down the street. We need to preserve that system. That's what this whole notion of judicial independence is about. And so it's very important for citizens to understand that. I've had a lot of opportunities to work with the media, and I've done journalism throughout my career to have long discussions so that we're on the same page with that. And sometimes you do have to allow others, like the professors, like the Bar Association presidents, like Cliff Haynes, who's the president of the Bar Association here in Pennsylvania, to be the spokesperson, because, frankly, the judiciary cannot defend itself, and it's not supposed to, really. It is supposed to be in its chambers doing its work, and that's how our system functions.
Or here in Carlisle doing a panel,
yes,
perhaps.
Exactly.
We're happy and fortunate to have you. I saw Judge Ebert with his hand up.
I'd be the last person to say that I've ever agreed with every appellate judge who's been elected over me, and they've certainly told me that on many occasions. But by and large, I like the elected system because it does give the opportunity for a common man to get into one of these positions. The political winds blow back and forth between Republican and Democrats routinely. Even our federal brothers here, some are appointed by Republican presidents who have an agenda, and some are by Democrats. I think each one of them, though, if anyone's sitting here right now and says that decisions in our appellate courts are being made because of what lawyer gave big contributions, I just don't see it. Each one of them has to look at each other, and they know what's going on behind the minds, and it's still a majority vote on each particular case. So I haven't seen the upswell of corruption in Pennsylvania because we have elected elections. I just don't see it. And I can tell you, like somebody, if there were these big judicial panels, etc., somebody like Justice Aiken, who came from a little county like this, who just by and large hit it pretty well about the way the swing in politics went that particular year, I'd say is doing a pretty good job. He's not corrupt, and he, you know, isn't influenced by other people, but other what his conscience are. And looking at his brothers and sisters on any one of the courts he's served and said, this is probably the best decision.
President Judge Bordelli.
I was only going to make a comment just because it was something that Ken was talking about, and he, of course, I agree with everything he said, but this is where I want to pay a compliment to the media. Because 2 years ago, in 2007, there were, I think, eight judges up for retention on the appellate courts in Pennsylvania. And there was a tremendous push by both the bar associations, local and state. Also, there was a great deal of interest and involvement of the academia and the idea that judges couldn't defend themselves, and yet there was a certified and organized effort to unseat a lot of those judges simply because, not because of anything those judges had done as appellate judges, but simply because of a general sense and a mood of discontent within the state. And I have to applaud the media because, but for the fact that you took the time, you listened to what was being said by the bar associations. You ran the editorials and the op-ed pieces. I think that a great deal of damage could have been done. And I know as a member of the Superior Court and its president judge, I had three members of the court who were outstanding judges running for retention in 07 with 30 years of appellate experience. And had they been lost, it would have cost the taxpayers of Pennsylvania a great deal more than money to replace those individuals. So from that standpoint, I realize that elections for judges aren't sexy, but they're also very important, and I want to thank the media for that.
Mark Scalfaro?
Well, the judges, though, aren't completely defenseless in this case. I mean, you folks didn't get elected without the support of the party apparatus in your county or your state, and those organizations certainly spoke up that time. It wasn't a matter of being thrown to the wolves. I feel like I do have to point out, though, that a lot of the support for the existing system, and I'm not coming down for it or against it, but some of the most impassioned support for it does come from the folks who are the product of it. And I mean, that's, that deserves to be said. Not the most objective. They picked me, so the system must work. But that's not the consensus. There are definitely other points of view about that.
As we approach wrap-up, I'm going to ask any panelists if they've got one point that they haven't made that they'd like to, and I saw Bill's hand go up.
Yeah, first of all, I applaud a session like this where people can speak candidly and collegially. And this stems from your first question, John. But, looking out at the audience, some of the people that I've covered, I realized that my ability to get information and perspective from current judges stemmed from my relationship with them before they were judges. And I'll name names. Justice Fitzgerald, I knew before when he ran for city controller. Ben Lerner in Philadelphia, a common pleas judge, was the public defender. Judge Klein, now deceased, was the head of Orphans Court. And there are many, many others. All of those people I got to know when they were public officials before they were judges. But because of the mutual trust and respect and rapport, I could call any of them at any time and get perspective and information. There are two types of sources for those of you who are aspiring journalists. One are what I call sources of information. They're in the absolute epicenter of the news. Governor Rendell, the head of the city council, the mayor, the district attorney. And then there are others. And those, in my opinion, are a lot more valuable than the people in the epicenter of the news. They're sources of expertise, like many of the people sitting here. And if they speak to reporters on an off-the-record basis and share their years of experience, their wisdom, their opinions, and never get quoted, the media is going to be able to write with a lot more understanding and nuance and ultimately serve the public. I think when the information gets filtered through public information officers who are well-intentioned and conscientious but aren't as expert, the material gets diluted. So I, for one, believe very strongly that judges ought to take the time and make the effort to talk with reporters on a one-to-one basis, see how it goes. In the long run, in my experience, it enhances the quality of the news and enhances people's understanding of a democracy. So I would urge all of you to give that a try. It certainly helped me, helped the Inquirer, and I believe it helped the Inquirer's readers.
Anyone else on this side like to make a point that they haven't had a chance to make? Stephanie Larson.
Yes, I just want to tell people who are interested in finding out what the court does not to rely on mainstream conventional media, especially television. And while people say, oh, television's dying, well, it's not dying as fast as newspapers are. And the newspapers are really where you're going to get the best kind of coverage. There are certain blogs, maybe from academic end, where you're going to also get some good stuff. But kind of your just regular chatty blogs, no. And television, no. About 10% of Supreme Court cases are covered on television, and more by people, who are moving their way around different cases at different times and don't have as much of the background, legal background. And the Supreme Court gets a lot more coverage than Court of Appeals. The data on that is like 0.1% of the cases that go through the Federal Court of Appeals get any media coverage at all. And that coverage tends not to focus on the legal issues. It's like, really? That's disheartening. And these are independent scholars who've like looked at this coverage and said, what is in there? There's a lot of attention on First Amendment. Not surprisingly. And it's not going to really give you the sense of what's happening in the court generally. I mean, you have to do more work, and in a fragmented media society, it's out there to do. There are resources that can help.
Just following up on that, in Philadelphia for years, there have been a group of people called court watchers. They've discovered something that most citizens don't realize. You can go to a courthouse yourself. You can sit in a trial and get the information firsthand. And I make this recommendation to people all the time. You know, in Philadelphia, go down to 6th and Market, to the federal courthouse. Go to the Criminal Justice Center. See how it really works firsthand. And, you know, the best way sometimes for a citizen to become educated about the way the system works.
Chief Justice Steele.
I just wanted to thank everyone on behalf of the Supreme Court for appearing here today and talking about these important issues, and the Judicial Independence Commission and Dickinson College for your kindness. I am convinced that in a democracy, in a republican system such we have, the guardians of freedom are independent courts and a free press. And that's what this is all about. And I'm do all I can to make sure we have an independent press, free press, and an independent judiciary.
Thank you. Anybody else on this side? How about over here? Anybody have a final point they'd like to make?
Well, I'd just like to assure Professor Larson that newspapers aren't dying quite as fast as she might be concerned about, and we intend to be here for a long time and hopefully doing our job.
Why don't you talk as a case in point with the Patriot News combined circulation on the net, readership on the net, and in print, as where it's gone in the
right,
last
year. Actually, we have more readers than we ever have in the combined readership. It's going online, and we've adapted to that. But there are a lot of people out there hungry for news that is responsibly reported. And while I know what you mean, and certainly agree with you, that there are many alternative forms of information that are responsible, I think we're all aware of the way that the term mainstream media is used as an epithet these days, and so-called other sources of information, which are in fact often sources of opinion or sources of so-called reporting that don't adhere to the kinds of responsibility or standards that we aspire to. Whether we fall short or not, we aspire to them. That's why the journalists who are here today are here today, and we hope to be continuing to do that for a long time.
Two of the top websites in the United States, based on Nielsen research, and probably in the top 15, but at least the top 20, are the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette and Philly.com. They're always up there. They have a lot of readership, a lot of issues, and they're good for educational purposes, too.
And let me just say, as someone who has worked extensively with the media, in my view, journalists as a group have more integrity than virtually any other profession that I've ever dealt with. And I do think that some of the points that have been made, that if you develop relationships of trust and if you actually talk out these issues, including, again, with the judiciary, who often can't talk for themselves but do have to have others speak for them, that usually the media does get it right and wants to get it right, and that's the great thing about having a program like this today.
Okay, from the press's viewpoint, is there any one thing you'd like to see from the other side, the judiciary, as you leave here? And I'll give that question back the other way, too. Any one thing that you'd like to see come out of it?
I'd like to see more uniform rules about the allowance of technology in the courtrooms and more unified access to information from all the courts. Court information, docket information, verdict information.
Okay.
I personally think there's some progress that can be made in the area of legal writing, that a lot of the decisions that you issue are written without the general public in mind, and when people like Hank and I try to decipher them, you know, we would benefit more if you all made more of an effort to think about the audience not being lawyers and judges, but people.
I must say that as I looked through some cases that Judge Jones had given me and Chief Judge Castile had brought up, as I tried to decipher them, I was afraid that in 5 or 7 words, I wasn't going to get it right. So I took a pass on those and just stayed with the general trend. On the other side of that, is there anything that the judges, justices would like to see that, you know, or has a wish for?
Well, Judge Bedell. Say, I'm going to keep writing my opinions the way I write my opinions, because lawyers and judges do read them, and the, you know, normal people are spared that, luckily. But I would say, call me. If you're reading it and you don't understand it, call me, and I'll tell you in common sense language exactly what it does mean. And if someone calls and says, I'm reading this opinion, I want to report on it, I want to make sure I have it right, believe me, I will take that call.
Sounds good. Sounds fair. Anybody else want to weigh in on that one? If not, I think the other Judge Jones is going to wrap it up.
By the way, we have, in fact, I've gone to the president of judges, and we've actually discussed dealing with the press, and that it's an important thing, and I'm convinced of that. So hopefully we'll get more open communications back and forth. And the only other thing I'd request is just be fair. And talk to both sides.
Thank you, Chief Justice. This has been a marvelous opportunity. When you plan something like this, it always sounds good, looks good on paper, but I hope that everybody will agree that this has been just a terrific opportunity to have a good exchange of ideas. Would you please join me in thanking not just our judges, but our journalists and our academicians as well. And please join me in thanking our excellent moderator. I described him a couple hours ago as an entirely self-effacing gentleman. John Curley wasn't sure about this. I think when I called him, there was a long pause as I described to him what I thought his role would be. What an excellent moderator John has been. Please join me. Now, we're going to have a reception afterwards, but before we close, finally, let me thank the parents of the two co-sponsors, if you will, the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania. Chief Justice, we thank you for all that you have done and for co-sponsoring this through the commission today. And, of course, Dickinson College and the Clark Forum for hosting a very meaningful occasion. I am sure that through the fellowship that was established today and the dialogue that we had, we're going to clearly do better. These comments have been taken to heart, I think, on both sides. We thank you all for attending. We hope that we'll see you as you're able to remain at the reception afterwards. Have a very pleasant day. Thank you.